Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Misnomers. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Natural Selection Presents. We are here to talk about misnomers and things that might be mistakenly named. So I hope I've got the name for this episode right. But I'll check in with my fellow Natural Selection presenters. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Naomi.
Hello.
We have Nick.
Hello.
And I am other Nick. Hello. Have you guys had a nice week? Or 2 weeks, even? Yeah, I hadn't managed how to hit the unmute button on last week's episode, I realised. So you probably didn't hear all my amazing contributions.
Yeah, we wondered why you were just sitting in silently, Nick. I was
transfixed by your facts.
No, we missed you. We missed you. I'm glad to have you back. The whole team. The gang's back.
Have you had any interesting nature interactions in my absence?
I did.
Good.
Yes, I woke up one morning this past week, and I saw on my blanket a tiny, tiny spider crawling across my blanket like it was traversing the Alps. And so I picked it up and moved it. And then I thought, well, carry on, Mr. Spider or Mrs. Spider or, you know, Spider, Dr. Spider, Professor Dr. Spider. And then I woke up the next morning and coming down from the ceiling on a long, long thread right above my head was a bigger spider. And I wonder how fast spiders grow and if maybe it was the same spider.
How fast do spiders grow? I imagine for us, that's quite an interesting question. But for several of our listeners, a terrifying one.
How fast do spiders grow? Could unlock some deep phobias.
As fast as your imagination, everyone.
It's true. So maybe it wasn't the same spider. I just hope that it wasn't that spider had eaten my spider from the earlier morning.
We all hope.
Thanks.
Naomi, have you got any potentially terrifying / tragic stories to share?
Not too terrifying, no. So actually, interestingly, almost immediately after I recorded the episode with Nick, I went for a walk and saw a heron, because Nick had seen a heron last... Yes, yeah. So it was actually standing on the grass in the park, near a pond, but not at the water. So it was kind of odd. We stood watching it for a while. They're quite big as well when you see it so close, and it got quite close to us. And I was trying to figure out why it was standing there, and kind of, like, as we were walking... Like, it started kind of walking in the same direction as this for a couple of minutes, a couple of seconds rather. And I realized that it was actually probably going for food that, like, either other animals were dropping or that, like, people were dropping. So, yeah, because there was a water hen that had gotten a little piece of food that a child had dropped and, you know, brought it back behind the fence. And then I could see the heron following and just as we were leaving. So I think perhaps it was looking for, like, dropped pieces of food from the birds.
I didn't learn that part of the food chain in my elementary school where the heron eats from the water hen, which eats from the toddler.
Yeah.
I love herons and I think they're amazing, but I suddenly developed a new fear from that story, which is being followed by a heron, especially on foot. I disappointingly haven't really seen any of them, being honest. I've barely left the house in 2 weeks. There's amazing stories about herons, but I think we should probably get on with the news. And Nick, you have some interesting news about mammoths.
Yeah, as you can imagine, Nick, very little news about mammoths coming out today is good, given that they're extinct. This just furthers the bad news with the mammoth. But luckily, it's from a while ago. So I think we've talked about mammoths quite a bit on this show, and this brings a new sort of perspective to the idea of why the mammoths went extinct. And the sort of general idea is that where mammoths cohabited with humans, they went extinct at the end of the last ice age around 10,000 years ago. In most places, of course, there were some weird island refuges, like in the Siberian Sea. Wrangel Island was one of these refuges where mammoths died out about 3,700 years ago. So much shorter in time. I know that's really 10,000 to 3,000 is the sort of range there that we're talking about. But this study was looking at evidence from fossils, mammoth fossils, and from ancient DNA, and trying to get a sense of the relationship between mammoth extinctions and human spread through Eurasia. And so this is coming from an international team. It's a preprint in BioArchive, so it's freely accessible. So the study is looking at the timing of range collapse, sort of seeing how the habitats of mammoths got shorter and shorter and shorter over time, and they were eventually extirpated or removed from certain areas by the encroaching human expansion. And then eventually they went extinct. And they're looking at what happened to humans during this time, which has been pretty well studied. There's this population growth during the late Pleistocene, where people migrated northward from southern Europe, from Africa, into the sort of northern Europe, and also into the northern North America area, which is where mammoths sort of had their wide range and big domain. And in many cases, they found these models that they're finding in this study showed that what would have happened with warming climates would have eventually caused the mammoth's range to shrink anyway, and probably they would have gone extinct. But the human presence where there were people hastened this decline by up to 4,000 years faster. So it made the mammoths go extinct much faster than they would have on a human scale. And interestingly, this is the part of the study that I like the most, which is that their simulations found areas of the mainland Arctic where mammoths were likely persisting until the mid-Holocene, about 5,000 years later than thought, so 5,000 years ago. So we know that these mammoths lived on islands until about 4,000 years ago. But we thought that they went extinct on the mainland and the continents 10,000 years ago. And these models say that in remote places of the Arctic, where people didn't exist, it seems likely that mammoths could have lived 5,000 years longer, and we just don't have any evidence of them based on the DNA, ancient DNA and fossil evidence that they have, these models predicting this. So it's just a model, of course, but it's interesting to think that maybe there were some mammoths living up there in the Arctic a lot longer than we thought they could have. So this sort of expands the idea that humans caused the extinction of woolly mammoths in one sort of quick overkill moment, rather was like a long range short shrinking and shortening process.
Humans, every time.
I know, right?
One day we'll have a good story about us, but today is not that day.
Alas, no.
I've got fun news for you. How do you guys feel about bats?
I love bats. You know, it's not a popular opinion, but I love them.
I also really like bats.
Well, you guys are going to love this story. So this is from some researchers from the University of Ottawa, and it was published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, or the Biogeosciences. What it is these researchers were looking for a way to study bat populations through time. And how they did this was through a huge pile of guano. Yeah, not to beat around the bush, is bat poo. So these researchers, they really know their guano. What they did is, you guys are probably familiar with when they look through lake sediment cores or ice cores, where they dig down through a certain distance and pull up a long core, and then they can examine the sediment to find out more about the geography or the life of the region, things like pollen deposits and stuff like that. So they tried this with guano, and this guano was a huge pile. So I think it's over 4,000 years old, this guano pile, and it's over 2 meters tall, so taller than most people. They're able to look at the bat's diet. So in this cave, there are about 5 different species of bats which live there and contribute to this guano pile. And what they were looking for was sterols, because as the bats eat things, either animal or plants, the sterols will come out in their guano. Plant sterols are often different to animal sterols. So, for example, a very famous animal sterol that we have in our body is cholesterol. So if they found cholesterol in the deposits, it means they were eating animals. Where if they found plant sterols, it was evidence that they were mainly eating plants. And they were able to use this deposit, which they found was actually really well structured. So it wasn't random. It was actually going through time. And the deeper you went, the further back in time it was. And they were able to compare the climate data with this data. So what they found was, by looking at the climate data, that fruit diets were favored during dry periods. So when the periods were hot and dry, it meant that either bats were more likely to eat fruit, or that bats that eat fruit were more successful and were more likely to live in the cave. So this shows that, yeah, that these climates can affect bat populations. And it was a really, really interesting way to do this and an amazing way to look back through time. They were even able to spot things that human beings had done. So in the guano pile, they could find evidence for the introduction of leaded gasoline and evidence of nuclear testing. So, yeah, again, humans not doing great, but bats, really interesting.
I love that the more we sort of dive into like putting together the piecing together the past, the more we get our hands dirty with weird and cool ways of finding clues, like Bat Guano.
Yeah. Do not envy those researchers.
Yes. Sorry if I missed this, but how long a time period was the guano covering?
I think they say 4,300 years-ish.
Cool. Wow.
From one flying thing that's not a bird to another, Naomi? I mean, your news, not you.
Yeah, so I actually had a question for you guys. So this is a piece of research that was published in Current Biology. It was led by researchers from institutes in China and Brazil. And it was the discovery of a new type of pterodactyl. And it had a really interesting feature. So I wanted to read part of the research paper that says what the feature is. And I want to see if you guys can figure out what it is, because it took me a while and I had to read another article explaining what it was. So the new species exhibits the oldest record of palmar or true opposition of the pole, which is unprecedented for pterosaurs. Do you guys know what that is?
No.
I'm going to go for, it's a long shot. Is it to do with their chest bone?
It is not.
Oh, what is it?
So the name of the species is Cunpengopteris antipolicatus, and the last part of its name comes from the words opposite and thumb, so in ancient Greek. So it has an opposable thumb, and it's been given the nickname monkey dactyl. So it was a fossil that they found in China in 2019, and they used micro-CT to create a 3D rendering of the fossil, and they found that it has an opposable thumb, which is the first time they found this in a pterodactyl, and is quite rare among non-mammal vertebrates. But something interesting that it says about this pterodactyl is that it's an adaptation for living in trees. So, and based on this and other morphological traits that the fossil had, the researchers were able to say that they're pretty sure that it lived in trees, which is interesting because the pterosaurs lived during the Mesozoic and they were the first vertebrates to evolve power of flight, as we've discussed before. And arboreal locomotion has been proposed for some of the groups and probably being considered a origin for how that helps them fly. So this is a good step in that direction, that this is a proof of at least this species having a tree living lifestyle, which is pretty cool. They also showed that it seemed to be able to exhibit niche partitioning with its close relatives, because it's able to use kind of a different part of the forest by climbing in the trees.
That's really cool.
Opposable thumbs on pterodactyls. What will they come up with next?
And I feel it fits really nicely into our theme this week, because I can't think of a worse nickname for it than monkey dactyl. I feel like if we sat down for a while, we could really come up with a better pun.
Terra thumb. No.
We'll stay on it.
I'll work on it.
That does bring us to the end of the news. Please join us after this short break, where we will be back to talk about our main theme, which this week is misnomers. So we are here to talk about misnomers. And anyone who's been a long-term listener will know that we, as taxonomists, have ranted about badly named wildlife on several occasions. So we thought we'd give over this very first part of our theme to our personal bugbears. Nick, I believe you have a very specific personal bugbear related to our news.
I do. I'm so glad, Naomi, you ended with the monkey dactyl, because that's the perfect segue into what we're about to talk about. Bugbear is a good example. That's not a bug nor a bear. But this theme that I wanted to talk about very briefly is dinosaurs. And dinosaurs is one of those ones that everyone feels like they own it. Dinosaurs. Yeah, I know what a dinosaur is. I grew up with my dinosaur. I had my horse phase and then my dinosaur phase. So did I, buddy. But took me until I was 27, 28 to figure that one out. What a dinosaur is and what a dinosaur isn't. So all of those things that we think of in, you know, Jurassic Park, a dinosaur is a group that contains the most recent common ancestor of birds and the non-avian dinosaur Triceratops. Hold those two in the palm of your hand, find their most recent common ancestor, and then all the descendants of that guy are dinosaurs. That doesn't include pterodactyls. It doesn't include ichthyosaurs. Doesn't include mosasaurs, doesn't include the sail, that guy with the sail, Dimetrodon. That's more closely related to mammals. But basically, when we're talking about dinosaurs, we're talking about an evolutionary group that's all related to it. They're all closely related to each other. We've talked about this before on the podcast, the monophyletic groups. But one of the characteristics of this group is that they have an interned femur. So if you look at the back legs of a dinosaur in a movie or in your local natural history museum, see if the leg bones, the thighs, turn in to fit into the hips, there's your dinosaur. And of course, they also include all modern birds. So that's my little rant on dinosaurs. Happy to keep ranting any day.
I feel like you've really cleared up that muddy water, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
But you really helped your cause by sticking birds on at the end there.
Yeah, right? It's a little bit like...
That's not complicated things, yeah.
I know. I love... The thing that blows my mind is that penguins are dinosaurs. Like, birds, I get it. Herons, like we've talked about, they look like dinosaurs when they're flying around. But, man, penguins. Kiwis.
My bugbear is a lot shorter than yours. Tarantula hawks, right? I mean, someone went out and called it a tarantula hawk. And you're thinking, like, tarantula hawk. Okay, so that hawk probably looks a bit like a spider. And you think, no, it's not a bird at all. So you're like, all right, so what, this tarantula is, like, as big as a bird or something? No, it's a wasp. So we've named this wasp after two things which are absolutely not insects. But, yeah, I don't know why they've done that. I know why they've done it, because it hunts tarantulas. But it's never going to be a hawk.
No.
So sort that out, world.
The way that they hunt tarantulas is nothing like a hawk.
Oh, no, not at all. If hawks did that, hawks would be much more terrifying.
Yeah. Listeners, they're parasitoid wasps.
Yeah, Google them. They're horrible, and they have a silly name. Naomi, I think you have one, which might be, rather than something that makes you mad like me, is one of your favorite animals.
So I was just about to say that, actually, that it's not so much that I'm annoyed that it's named this, but that I just really like talking about this animal. So I wanted to talk about the mantis shrimp, which is not a mantis or a shrimp. It's a crustacean, so it's an arthropod. And there's some really cool features of it. It's really beautifully colored, and it has an incredible amount of color receptors in its eyes, 16 color receptors. So who knows what it's able to see? It's very impressive. Another really cool thing it does is it's able to move its front appendages so fast that it can boil the water through some sort of process called supercaviation, and that helps kill its prey. Appendages are so strong, it can break aquarium glass. It isn't a shrimp, and I wanted to explain the difference between it and a shrimp, and I'll use mammal terms because it helps my mammal brain understand it. It's in the same class, but not the same subclass, so it would be as related as humans are to kangaroos. So it's a mammal, we are placental mammals, and they are marsupials.
Well, there you go. A quick rundown of three things which particularly annoy us about how things have been named. And yeah, speaking of bugbears, one of my major ones that has come up several times is, as the resident insect correspondent, is bugs. This is very much a particular bugbear for me. Many things are called bugs, but many things are not bugs. So, for example, ladybugs, pill bugs. Most people, when they see an insect, they'll be like, oh, it's a bug. It's often not. So bugs are a very specific type of insect. And do you guys know what makes a bug a bug?
They're creepy crawly.
Is it to do with their mouth parts?
Here comes Naomi with the brains, as always. Do you know what's different about them?
They have, is it like sucking mouth parts?
She's really good. Yeah, they have sucking mouth parts, which are fixed. So other insects will have sucking mouth parts that you're probably familiar with. Things like butterflies have sucking mouth parts that can, yeah, get deep into plants' things, and they can suck out the nectar. Whereas bugs have sucking mouth parts which are fixed in place. They're not like the butterfly can actually unfurl theirs. If you watch a butterfly for long enough, you'll actually see it unfurl its sort of tongue. Bugs can't do this. They're very, very fixed. And they will use this to access nectar, or maybe sometimes the inside of other insects as well. They're called Hemiptera, which actually translates as from Greek. Any guesses? This is where Nick might shine.
Something wings, but I don't know what the hem means. Oh, half wing.
Yes, it is. So certain types of bugs have half wings, which isn't exactly true. So what it is, so if you imagine a dragonfly wing or a fly's wing, you can imagine that it's quite see-through and delicate. Now, if you imagine the beetle's elytra, the sort of thing that covers its back, is sort of hard and rigid. So the Hemiptera, many of them have half hard, half soft wings. And that's where they get their name. So you can see pictures of them, and they're sort of two coloured wings, and they're called half wings. But that's not all of them by any means. They're a huge order of insects, so there's this huge variety. What keeps them in common is, one, their mouth parts, which are fixed and sucking. The other thing is, see if you guys remember this from a previous episode, you will get serious brownie points if you do. They are hemimetabolous. Do you know what that means?
They don't do the full metamorphic cycle, but only part of it.
Yes. So when they are in their nymph phase, they actually just look pretty much like smaller adults, as opposed to things like flies, which look like maggots, or butterflies, which look like caterpillars. So they will just, like, when they are growing, they will just shed their skin and get gradually bigger and bigger until they reach their adult final phase. So that's the other thing they have in common. And they're pretty old. I think, their fossil record traces back to the Triassic. So they're very, very old. And they include some very, very famous examples, including aphids might be the most famous example. But generally shield bugs as well, quite famous. Cicadas, which are the loudest insect. They're a type of bug. Also, you know that red dye that you get from insects? Cochineal?
Yeah.
That is from a bug.
A true bug.
Yeah. It's called Natural Red 4, the dye, and it's used in many, many things. Famously, it used to be used in Red Smarties, but I think they replaced it with a non-animal variety. So there you go. That's what makes bugs a bug. So next time you see an insect and you call it a bug, check its mouth parts, check its wings, check its life cycle, a bit harder. See if it does actually match up to what a bug is. But I suppose the problem with bugs is it's become colloquially a catch-all name. And this, I believe, can be quite problematic for scientists. Isn't that right, Nick?
Oh, that's so right. And I'm so glad you led me in that way, Nick, because I have a topic just for you. You are the resident bug expert for sure. You like your creepy crawlies as much as the next guy, but I'm not particularly a fish person. Or I am, but we'll get to that later. What I want to talk about is the word fish first, and sort of introduce and discuss some of the confusion and complication around that topic. When I say fish, what do you think?
Sushi.
Naomi?
Sea swimming animals.
Yeah. great. So one of the things that comes up when we're talking about...
Do you know what Naomi's got against freshwater fish?
Oh, Nick, thank you. Listen, it's a tough game, taxonomy. No one can win. one of the things that comes up is, what is the plural of fish? And I'm sure you've heard that, well, it's fish. You know, you see two fish swimming. And that works if it's the same species. But in scientific context, if you're talking about more than one type of fish, two different species or groups, you can call them fishes. So when in The Godfather they say he sleeps with the fishes, they are just really being clear that there's more than one kind of fish where he's been drowned. So in this case, fish refers to plural, fishes refers to different types of fish. So that out of the way, let's dive into some things that aren't fish. I've got a big list for you today. I'm just going to blast through them, and then we'll talk about what they actually are.
I'm pretty sure the plural of sushi is sushi, so that works as well.
That works too, but if it's different kinds of sushi, different...
Sushis.
Yeah, different. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're catching on. Good. So we've got shellfish, cuttlefish, starfish, crayfish, silverfish, and jellyfish. Sounds like a poem, if you ask me. It's all wrong. So I'm going to talk a little bit about these different lovely animals and what they actually are. Shellfish, this is one of the worst ones, the worst offender, colloquial term, and also used by the industry for any exoskeleton-bearing aquatic invertebrate that's also used as food. And it includes mollusks, crustaceans, and echinoderms. There's no other term for this besides shellfish. If you want to talk about all those things, that's the term you can use, and we're stuck with it. Fish they'll be.
Yeah, they're not monophyletic though, are they?
Not at all. They're in completely different groups. So this includes, for example, some mollusks like scallops, but not other mollusks like snails. Snails wouldn't be considered shellfish, so it's not monophyletic and it's not a real biological group, but it's a common term. Cuttlefish, one of my favorite of animals of the sea, those cute cephalopods, also mollusks, not fish, and now we can sort of get into our renaming, which I love. I found alternate names for most of the animals that we just went through. So we can correct ourselves and not call them fish any longer, but cuttles with T's. Starfish is a classic offender. They're echinoderms of many limbs, radial body plan. We now call them sea stars. Crayfish is a fun one, especially for those of you not from the U.S. They're not fish that are, you know, crayfish. But they're also, they're freshwater crustaceans. They're pretty small. They live inland. I've seen them in rivers and the mountains. But they're also called crawfish, crawdads, crawdaddies, cratids, freshwater lobsters, mountain lobsters, mud bugs, and yabbies. I've never heard yabbies in the wild, though, so.
Can I immediately step in and say we're not calling them mud bugs?
Thanks, Nick. Yep. I'll wrap up with a little bit about jellyfish. And this one, I'll just use a quote from the research article that I was looking at here for this. The informal common name, jellyfish, is given to the medusa phase of certain gelatinous members of the subphylum Medusozoa, a major part of the phylum Cnidaria. And now we can call them not jellyfish, but sea jellies. Much simpler. So that's my little roundup on not fish.
That leads nicely into something else, because while jellyfish are not fish, Naomi, what you found is something that's not jelly.
Yes, exactly. So I wanted to talk about comb jellies. Their scientific name is ctenophores. There's a C there and it's silent. And it comes from the Greek, which means comb bearers. I wanted to talk about them because I think they got often lumped with jellyfish because they're kind of similar looking, but they are quite distinct. And I want to talk about them a little bit because there's some cool features that they have and also some interesting sort of research that's been done about them and their evolutionary history and disrupted what people thought of as known facts. So they're called comb bearers because they have 8 comb rows of fused cilia, which are arranged along the sides of the animal. So they use these cilia to swim and propel them through the water. So many microscopic organisms use cilia, but comb jellies are the largest known animal to be able to do this. And what's cool about the comb as well is when it beats, the light is scattered, so it actually produces a rainbow of colors. And not only are they able to produce this sort of color array, which is kind of more iridescent than it is bioluminescence, some species also are bioluminescent, which is interesting as well. Some species also have flapping lobes that then undulate on their body. And then many ctenophores have long tentacles. So there is about 100 to 150 valid species of ctenophores. And the reason this is kind of up in the air is because it's actually was being realized that a lot of them have been identified twice. So they have a lot of species that have been described, but it turns out that they're the same species. So at the moment, they think maybe 100 to 150 valid species, but there's also a couple more, maybe 25, that they have been recognized as distinct, but they haven't been described. So as you're maybe picking up, these aren't a hugely well-studied animal. They're found in lots of different places. They are found in most marine environments. They live in polar waters to the tropics, and mostly in the water column, but some of them are bottom dwellers. Most of the ones on the surface are transparent, but some of them are pigmented. So, for example, there's one called the Tortuga Red. So you might guess it's red.
You say you guess, but this episode should teach us one thing, is that might be blue.
That's true. That is a good point, yes. They also have no brains or central nervous system, but they have a nerve net that forms a ring around the mouth and is densest near structures such as the comb rows. So they're carnivores. Nearly all of them. I think I found one that was a parasite, but the majority of them are carnivores. So unlike jellyfish, cnidarians, they don't have stinging cells, which is what the jellyfish have. They have something else. They're sticky cells that are called coloblasts, and this helps them eat their prey. Also, some of them, their cilia have been adapted to help them eat their prey. So they tend to eat small zooplankton. So small crustaceans, invertebrates, snails, clams, things that are floating around in the plankton. Some of them actually also eat other ctenophores. There's one particular type that eats other ctenophores. So I say they don't have stinging cells, but one of them actually, the members of the genus Hakelia, they actually prey on jellyfish and they're able to incorporate their stinging cells into their own feeding equipment. So they do have nematocysts, which are the stinging cells, but they didn't make them themselves. Stole them. One interesting thing is that where they are in the Tree of Life is kind of disputed. And the reason it was disputed is because they have an anus. With the phylogenetic tree, they have certain features that would indicate that they're in a certain location on the Tree of Life. And some people think that they're kind of the sister group to all other animals, whereas a lot of people originally thought it was sponges. So it kind of goes back and forth about where they sit on the Tree of Life, because they have kind of similarities, but they think they evolved before these animals that only have one opening. So certain things only have one hole, including sea anemones, jellyfish, and possibly sea sponges. But they think that these comb jellies evolved before this. So either they evolved it separately, or these other animals maybe lost some of these features. But it's interesting, and I thought I would talk about comb jellies, because they're not combs or jellyfish.
I remember that. Was it Xenophores where we had the news about the disappearing anus?
It was. Apparently there's one, yeah, species. I think it's the warty comb jellyfish. Its anus only forms when it wants to defecate.
Thank you, that was really cool. I wanted to sort of take a little different tact on things with misnomers, because the animal I want to talk about isn't misnamed as such, but it's sort of famous for not being the animal everyone thinks it is. And I'm here to talk about Puffinus puffinus, which is, of course, the...
Puffin! No, I know, it's not. That's the whole point.
Yeah, it's not. And it's famously not the puffin. It's one of those trivia things where you're like, oh, the puffin is not a puffin. It's actually a Manx shearwater. But I feel like the only thing people know about Manx shearwater is that it's not a puffin. But actually quite amazing animals in their own right. So, for example, did you know that they are the longest living bird in the British Isles?
The longest living?
Yeah. They ringed an adult in the 1950s, and they found that adult again in the early 2000s. It was at least over 50 years old, and because it was an adult when it was rung, they estimated it was about 55 years old. But on average, they live about 15 years. Yeah, they're sort of a medium-sized shearwater. Manx, these are things that are from the Isle of Man, which is an island sort of above Wales, between Ireland and England in the Irish Sea. That's where it comes from. It has a great flag if you ever want to Google the Isle of Man. Why is its name Puffinus puffinus? Well, that's because originally a puffin wasn't a puffin. So the Manx shearwater, they lay their young in dens on land. These young are full of fat. They're very oily and fatty, and they were considered a delicacy. And in fact, in the Faroe Islands, they're still eaten to this day. People would eat them, and these were called poffins, poffins, or puffings, these tiny little fatty birds. This is why they got the name Puffinus puffinus, because this is their original puffin. But this name for the food began to apply for different birds as well, and eventually stuck in the middle of the 19th century to puffins. But this was after it got its scientific name. So that's why puffins are called puffins, and Puffinus puffinus is a Manx shearwater. They found records of this name as early as 1337 of them being called puffins. So that's where it's come from. But they're quite amazing animals. They have these amazing eyes. So what they do is when they're looking for food, they go out into the sea and they skate almost on the top of the water. They sort of fly very, very close to the point where they can actually dangle their wings and they will touch the water as they go. And their vision is very concentrated at the end of their beak. So what they'll be able to see, they think, is food in the sea at the end of their beak. This is very, very useful when they're sort of skimming the surface, so they'll be able to quickly dive down and find it. The other thing that I really liked about them is their vocalizations are partly why they're famous. So there are two islands in the Faroe Islands named after trolls. And they think it's because of the calls of these birds. So I listen to the calls of the birds, and they do just generally sound like quite throaty birds. According to the Vikings and the settlers that were there, they thought they were trolls, which, you know, really doesn't make me think Vikings were as brave as everyone said, because they would avoid these islands because they are actually silent at sea. But when they are on land, they make these vocalizations, and yeah, they got their names as troll islands. The other thing I really, really liked about them is they do something called rafting, where there's a very famous island, Skomer Island, off the coast of Wales, which you can visit. And just to close on this, that what they do is in the day they go out from the island, so you don't actually often see them. But they do something called rafting, where they sit in large groups all around the island. And in the daytime, they go away from the island, possibly to avoid predators. and in the nighttime they come close to the island. But it means they're in this huge ring around the island, and it sort of creates this halo effect where the birds go out and in a giant circle around the island. And then in the nighttime, they will eventually climb on land and head to their nest, where they will look after usually one young before flying off to spend their winters in Argentina.
Very nice.
Yeah. So that is the Manx shearwater for you there. Now, Nick, I believe you weren't done with your rant about fish.
Oh, no, I'm not done with my rant about fish. So this actually ties together two of the things that we talked about earlier, the dinosaurs and the difference between what we call dinosaurs and what actually are dinosaurs, and the fish issue. The fish issue. Thank you. Unlike the dinosaur issue, where we're calling things dinosaurs that aren't dinosaurs, when we say fish, we're actually referring to a much smaller group than what evolutionarily might actually be a fish. So usually when we call something by its true name, not in the sort of fantasy book sort of true name, but in the evolutionary biologist sort of true name, we're calling it by, like dinosaurs, the group of things that are in a group together. So something that you take the Triceratops, for example, and the modern bird, and the ancestor of their most recent common ancestors is then dinosaurs. So on a tree, if you drew a tree of life, the dinosaur branch would all be on one branch together, and we could call them dinosaurs. But when you get to things that were named before the idea of cladistics appeared, then you start to get some issues with names and evolutionary groups. So a classic example of this is fish. If we think about fish, they're sort of one of the earlier vertebrates to evolve. They were in the seas long before anything came onto land and became amphibians, reptiles, mammals. So that means that if you take a fish and look back on the tree to the point where the fish all started, they don't come from one branch. They come from many branches, and the branch that we're on, the tetrapod branch, the things with four limbs, came off of a fish branch. So if you want to be true to the evolutionary definition of fish, you have to include all tetrapods, which includes us. So you might say that we're fish. And at first, that sounds a bit shocking. And then if you think back to an episode we talked about a couple of weeks ago, we talked about your inner fish, where hiccups come from. And we talk about that evolutionary lineage of the fish inside of us. But it's not quite the same. And truly, I think that fish is not a biological term, or it shouldn't be used that way because it's confusing. Because when you think of fish, you think of sushi and sea-dwelling animals. And Naomi, when you said sea-dwelling animals earlier, when you thought of fish, I'm really glad that you said that, because for a long time, if you look back through the history of English, that's what fish meant. And today, we really refer to things with a medial body plan with fins and scales. Fish, though, for many hundreds of years, has referred to basically anything living in the seas. So I have some choice examples for you from the definition of fish from the Oxford English Dictionary that always has the little, like, sort of usage through time quotations from famous texts. And some of these are really excellent. So we'll start in the middle, 1695. Woodward's Essays of Natural Histories of Earth, Whales and Other Great Fishes. So even from the beginning, we're starting to see whales called fishes. And this comes up again and again. We get things like whales, seals, porpoises, dolphins called fish. But it goes even farther and weirder. You get things like crocodiles getting called fish just because they're sort of related to the sea monsters. As we move sort of through the history of fish, it gets closer and closer to the modern definition. But still, we have these like fishes and fish, like we talked about before, that the plurals, but now referring to things like pods of whales and schools of dolphin and things like this. So I love this idea that the terms for things change over time, and that something that sounds silly to us, like calling a whale a fish, was not silly at all 100, 200 years ago. And I wonder what we'll call fish in 100 years, because what we're calling fish now doesn't really make a lot of sense either.
I like these thought experiments. I suppose the big divide for me that I know is that, yeah, there's bony and non-bony fish, which seems like such a big difference. Like one of them has bones.
Yeah, and right. But we're more closely related to the bony fish than the bony fish are to the non-bony fish.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nick. A little deep dive into the ocean there. Hey. But Naomi, rather than looking at specific animals, you wanted to end on a term which you think might be misapplied.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about living fossils. And I want to talk about it kind of for two reasons. One is because it's sort of an oxymoron in a way, because it can't really be a living fossil. It's kind of a contradiction. But also, I wanted to talk about it a little bit because it's kind of a contentious term. So I wanted to talk about maybe some things, is it misapplied to some things? You know, and I kind of wanted to talk about it more as a conceptual topic, just briefly. A living fossil is an extant taxon, so that means that it's still alive, that cosmetically resembles ancestral species that are only known from the fossil records. So those are things like coelacanths, that's a type of fish, you know, we talk about fish, horseshoe crabs, which we've talked about before, lamp shells, ginkgos, tuatara, tadpole shrimp. So there's lots of different things that are called these living fossils. Some people aren't really sure about whether this term should be used or not. And I was reading a couple of research papers that are kind of talking about maybe some of the problems about it, but then also maybe some of the things that are good about it as well. So basically, a living fossil exhibits this sort of stasis over a long geological timescale. Literature sometimes claims these living fossils haven't undergone any significant evolution, which isn't really right. And sometimes, in particular, one research paper I was looking at was talking about the coelacanth, and it was looking at evolution on kind of a molecular scale in the coelacanth, and it was saying how not much was happening. But in some ways, the results it was getting could be interpreted that way, but they could also just be interpreted by a small sampling size. So sometimes when people are putting these terms on it, they're maybe taking pieces of information and assuming that it's correct or assuming that these things aren't really happening. But something that's interesting is maybe these minimal superficial changes of these living fossils can often be mistakenly said to be the absence of evolution. But it's not really the case, most likely. It's probably more stabilizing selection. So this is kind of a process. And I think it could be considered a dominant process of morphological evolution. And kind of basically, in a nutshell, I'm oversimplifying a little bit here, but basically it means that it goes back and forth in order to kind of eliminate any extremes. So it's kind of, evolution is sort of consistently happening, but it's always sort of ending up in the same place between kind of these two different extremes. So even though it seems like nothing's happening, there may still be evolution happening. But one of the pieces of work I was looking at kind of suggested that actually, while the term can maybe not be the best, it can bring up some interesting ideas as to why some of these features, and maybe you could look about it as features of an organism instead of the whole organism, and kind of why some of these things are still the way they are, have shown limited change over time. So yeah, I thought I'd talk a little bit about living fossils, and I will end with one thing I found in one of the research. It's a quote that says, "We hope that this review will contribute to dispelling the myth of the coelacanth as a living fossil and help biologists keep in mind that actual fossils are dead."
And Naomi, I also want to point out that horseshoe crabs, not crabs, double whammy on that one.
Or horseshoes.
Or horseshoes.
I don't know why that was less obvious to you. Thanks for that, Naomi. That does bring us to the end of this episode, all about misnomers. But we will be returning next week with a new theme, and we're going to go slightly out of our comfort zone again, and we're going to be talking about sea. So hopefully that will plant some ideas in your head.
I was going to say that.
Got any other ideas you could germinate, or?
Gah, shut up. You're taking the ones from my mouth, from the tip of my tongue.
I think it'll give us some food for thought.
Hey. but yeah, we will return next week to talk about seeds. But for now, until then, from all of us at The Natural Selection, goodbye.
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 fascinated by anything with a silent letter, because I am unique amongst the Nicholases here in that I have a silent letter in my name.
It's true. It's an unnecessary baggage, and I'm sorry
for
you.
But what really annoys me about my silent letter is that it could have been any letter if it's silent, and they went so basic with the H. Like, my parents really lacked ambition on that one. They could have had a Z or, you know, a Q. I could have had a Q in the middle of my name, be like, oh, the Q is silent. Because what difference does it make if the H is silent?
It could have been a classic P